Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Some things have been bubbling in Syria again. I guess we're not going to be able to get away from the area of Syria for a while here. The United States, or the president, announced that we were going to start aiding the rebels in Syria, and that's brought up a debate of what we should do and how we should do it and what the effect is going to be. What are your thoughts on this, Jim?
Well, I think what's deciding the war at the moment is, as the old saying goes, amateur study tactics, professional study logistics. And it's logistics and economics that is really killing the Syrian government right now. For example, 2 years ago when the fighting started, it cost 70 Syrian pounds, that's their currency, to buy $1. In the last week, it's gotten up to close to 200. In fact, it's made a big jump in the last week since the United States, or since Obama, made the announcement that we were really going to help, you know, the rebels with weapons and what have you so far. But what we've been already doing is sticking it to Iran, which has been suffering big time. Now, this doesn't get into the news much, but my contacts within Iran, or, you know, people who do business with Iran a lot, tell me that they're hurting big time. Their currency is also, you know, almost impossible to use to buy foreign currency, to buy imported items. And, of course, you can't buy dollars with, you know, Iranian rials. The Syrians have the same problem. They are also under multiple embargoes. The Turks, you know, turn the screws, are real nasty about what they let, you know, across the border. Iraq, which is basically an ally, is under a great deal of pressure, not just from the United States, but from Turkey and from the Sunni Arab countries, who are basically saying to Iraq, it says, look, we understand that Iran's going to be around for a while, but the bastards are killing Arabs. And this resonates with Shia Iraqis. I mean, gotta remember, they were most of the troops who fought Iran during the 1980s war were Shia Arabs. So if you play your cards right, which the Saudis and the Turks are trying to do, you can basically, if not cut off the access Iran has to Syria via Iraq, you can certainly throttle it. So this is what, Assad worries about. He worries about the economy, which is basically collapsing. And the economy is the main prize that he doled out to his supporters. They got jobs, they got concessions, they got basically monopolies over this or that. The business elite in Syria were always pro-Assad. I mean, you could not be a successful businessman in Syria unless you backed the Assad family. And he's calling in all those favors now, and more of these business families are liquidating and getting out of town, moving to Lebanon, moving to wherever they can go. And basically the Arab countries, the Gulf states, are abetting this by letting it be known that they will be accommodating if you want to get out and leave or possibly go back later. But be that as it may, they are helping fight the logistics war. If Syria does not have the money, does not have the economy, does not have the ability to feed the 20 or 30% of the population that more or less supports it, they will lose a lot of that support. Now, on the other side of the fence, one of the big pieces of assistance that the rebels want is logistics. In other words, the Arab states have been giving the rebels a lot of weapons and ammunition. The problem is getting it to them, logistics. Now, this might mean sending American and Western European special forces into Syria to help set up the transportation. They've gotten some Syrians to do this, but basically the factionalism among the Syrian rebels is a killer, and perhaps an outside help, you know, would help with this. But on both sides, you can see the biggest obstacles to the greater military success have been logistical. The rebels have basically armed men at this point, and more enthusiasm, but they can't move the weapons and supplies. They can't coordinate. The Syrians are coordinated, but their economy's falling apart. They have a plunging morale problem, even with the help of Hezbollah. And, of course, Iran, the rumor now is they're going to send in 4,000 soldiers. Well, if they are, they better get them there quick, because the Saudis have made it clear to Iraq that if they allow free passage of Iranian soldiers into an Arab state, there will be consequences. That sounds more ominous if you say it in Arabic, I'm told. But, you know, the word has been put out that, you know, these are the limits. And Iran is desperate to win. So they might, you know, take extraordinary measures, you know, getting their troops through Iraq to ensure that the Assad stay in business. But the end game, which a lot of Assad supporters are saying now, what kind of victory can there be? We're going to be on the world's, you know, hit list even after we've, quote unquote, won, beating the rebels. The rebels will be in neighboring countries, you know, still taking pot shots at us. We'll still have sanctions. What kind of future is there even with a victory? And this is the kind of thing that the United States is the principal author of, because we have basically cut, and this is something that, again, doesn't get much play in the news, in the last year that the heavy sanctions have been on Iran, their oil shipments went down to less than half the end of last year. Then the Iranians started to make all sorts of crazy deals, you know, cut rate prices, we'll pay shipping charges, et cetera, et cetera. It went up for a bit earlier this year. Now it's down under 50% again. And the reason is quite simple. The United States and the other Western countries, but the United States has been the lead in this. God help me, they have been some medals on lawyers, you know, and accountants for doing the heavy lifting on this, have gone after anybody who's slipping, you know, helping the Iranians and saying, hey, look, you want to lose all your banking connections, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there are threats that can be made. They basically develop a package of offers people cannot refuse. And this is putting the screws to Iran. And Iran is the only one who can basically supply Syria with money. They gave them a $1 billion line of credit, but that might not even be good the way things are going in Iran. So the situation is not as bleak as it looks, and you shouldn't pay so much attention to the fighting, because it's not the fighting that's going to decide this.
Interesting. Austin?
Well, let me point out something, an element that has given the United States the strategic flexibility that Jim points out to put pressure on Iranian oil exports and gas exports as well. It's fracking, Dan, and increased production in North America, and that has provided some a flexibility on the market. You've also had the cooperation of Saudi Arabia, which is the world's swing producer. So you see there in the case the energy flexibility has put the squeeze on Iran, and that's why Jim is saying that you're seeing this worked out finally, both the diplomatic and military operational level. Don't always see it at the tactical level. A couple of things I want to mention, though, that Assad still got going for him. He's got firepower superiority. He still has rockets, still has artillery, still able to put attack helicopters and aircraft in the air. He still has armor. Manages to get enough fuel and maintenance capability to keep tanks running and armored personnel carriers running, and that gives them tactical superiority when they go into a neighborhood. Then they go into a neighborhood, they shell the neighborhood. They don't care who they hit. There are press penalties, so to speak, and they have the armor there. So there's a tactical advantage. Now, another advantage they have is that Jim mentioned the Iranian support, and this is to me is one of the more fascinating things that has emerged out of the Syrian civil war, and that's the intrusion of Lebanese Hezbollah, the Arab Shia, Lebanese Shia organization that in many ways is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian government. Certainly the billions of dollars that Iran has put into Hezbollah has changed the domestic political calculus within Lebanon. It's made Hezbollah the premier militia and premier political force in Lebanon. That's Iranian money and Iranian arms. The rockets are all oriented, of course, at least they claim to, towards the towards Israel, the enemy, the propaganda enemy. Actually, they have so many enemies. Hezbollah does, the Sunni Arabs and the Christians and the Druze within Lebanon as well. But the intrusion into Syria has torn the you now see the man behind the curtain, to invoke the Wizard of Oz. The propaganda enemy, Israel, is not under attack. It's Sunni Arabs in Syria. And they are being used, the Lebanese Hezbollah, as a proxy army by the Iranians. This is has strengthened the hand politically of other factions within Lebanon, Christians, Sunnis, Druze, and the like, and has undermined Lebanese Hezbollah and the Iranian position in Lebanon. That's good news. The bad news is that they have had tactical success against Syrian rebels inside Lebanon. And has maintained, been able, that's another way that the Assad regime has been able to maintain itself, because it's been able to import reliable, well-trained fighters. Now, I think in the long term, this is a huge mistake on the part of Iran and the Assad regime to bring Lebanese Hezbollah into the mix in Syria. I think it's very damaging to Lebanese Hezbollah. But in the short term, in the desperation that the Assad regime faces, it's provided them with a sustaining edge. I agree with everything Jim said about the logistical issue, but there's also this issue. Which rebel organizations are you going to favor? Inevitably, some of the weapons and ammunition are going to end up in the hands of some of these Sunni radical organizations, like Al-Nusra, Jim? Al-Nusra. I know, but that's not the entire name of the outfit. I know where they operate, you know, and I know who they operate with. I'm just not coming up with their name right now. But they're an Al-Qaeda affiliate. And that's going to show up in the newspaper that they got U.S. weapons. Let's hope they don't get shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles or the like. But we need to make certain that the predominance, the overwhelming weapon support, ammunition support, logistical support, communication support, political support, goes to the elements of the Free Syrian Army that really are interested, dedicated to establishing, it's going to take a long time to do it, but establishing a democratic umbrella political movement to replace the Assads and have the military experience, military capacity to turn on the extremist Sunni groups once the Assad regime is defeated. I don't have a time frame for this, but those are some of the operational and then strategic considerations that we need to think about very, very carefully as we go into more direct U.S. and Western Europe, more direct support for Syrian rebels.
Jim, what other help are the rebels getting from other Western countries at this point?
Well, the exiles, several million people who have been chased out of their homes, are basically being supported by the West, by Western charity, food, medical supplies, you name it. And the host nations, mainly Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, and to a lesser extent Iraq, are putting up with a lot of, you know, unpleasantness. You know, all these people camped out. A lot of them are not too happy and express it occasionally. Plus, there's more, you know, crime. Some of them go looking for jobs. But the most of the money and material support is coming from the West. And then there are the weapons that are going in. But the biggest thing they need from us, they want from us, is air support. They saw what happened in Libya, and they basically keep saying, we want Libya. Why aren't we like the Libyans? Now, something can be learned from what is happening right now in Libya, where they have the same problem with all the Islamic radical groups being the most effective fighters, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, getting into all kinds of mischief after, you know, Gaddafi was gone, and, of course, killing our ambassador along the way. The Libyans are now finally, they're turning on those militias. I mean, this started out not as a government thing, because the government was too chicken, you know, to basically do anything, but popular, and I'm talking not just, you know, mobs of people, but mobs of people with guns, have started chasing some of the worst militias out of the cities. And this has created, you know, other militias have come to the help of the militia, the chased out militias. They're killing civilians. Well, you can see where this is going. The end game is the militias will be gone. I mean, and of course, this is the same thing that happened in Iraq, you know, 5 years ago. With the big terror campaign, the victims decided enough, and of course the Shia started terrorizing Sunni civilians. And bingo, next thing you know, it coincided with the surge, but the basic thing that caused the Sunnis, most of the Sunnis, to switch sides was the fact that, you know, Shia death squads were going around killing their women and children. So this is not something you negotiate. This is something that just happens. Now, that's difficult to sell politically. You know, if I got in front of Congress and said this, people would start turning green, you know, and thinking, oh, my God, disaster, getting them out of here. But that's what reality's like. It's often unpleasant. There's especially when there's a certain inevitability to it. But what the rebels need right now is a victory. Then we can start working on the Islamic you know, radicals. In fact, the longer the radicals are there, the more damage they're going to do to Syria. I mean, they got death squads running around now killing, you know, Shia civilians. And, of course, the Shias have their own militias, which are killing Sunnis. So, you know, how many women and children do you want to have slaughtered? Well, that's the price of not, you know, giving the rebels air support. And again, that's a hard sell in Washington, where you got to be so politically correct. It's the same thing in Western Europe. The media doesn't want to show that. The media doesn't even want to talk about that. But hey, you know, this is not something we're inventing. We're just, we look at history, you know, current affairs like history. In this case, you only have to look back 2 years and fast forward. You want to see the future? Look at Libya. You know, and of course, you want to see what's happening to the civilian population in Syria? Well, just look at Iraq 5 years ago. You know, what goes around comes around, and it happens with a vengeance, a bloody vengeance at that, you know, in this case.
Let me add something to that, Dan. Jim says it just happens, turning on the radicals, and what we're seeing occurring over the last few months in Libya is what many of us hoped would happen, you know. Eventually, that the Islamic radicals, the Al-Qaeda affiliates, would be driven out. The thing is, I don't think it just happens so easily. You don't want to give the radicals an edge by them getting hold of sophisticated weapons. They're going to try to get some anyway, but you want to try to limit what's going to bleed through to them. But you have to provide support to moderate Islamists, political centralists that do exist, some of the secularist groups, some of the smaller sectarian groups in Syria that are ultimately interested in what I call this democratic umbrella organization. Okay, yeah, it's going to be something of a complete, you know, pig with lipstick, but at least it is an organization where the various groups have saying, all right, we're committed to something other than the Assads, something other than Al-Qaeda, something other than Iran's, that we're going to work out a modus vivendi among ourselves. We're not going to end up looking like Great Britain and France or the United States or Canada. I think we know that. But then there's the opportunity for them to, let's say, reach some sort of a democratic political accommodation. That means you've got to provide them with the money. You've got to provide them with the diplomatic support. You've got to provide them with special operations forces trainers, perhaps, to sharpen their military skills, so that when the time comes that they have to face down the radical Islamists, they're prepared to do it and they're able to carry it out. And yes, some of it will happen, as Jim says, it's going to be organic, but it's because you've also got, you know, we have spent some money propping up the central government in Libya, and I think it's money well spent. As weak as the central government is, it's still there. And then when these individual groups, these more moderate militias, are so fed up with what the extremists are doing, they have something to use as a backup when they turn on the Islamists. So anyway, let me add that at least to Jim's model about Libya.
Now, things have continued to happen in Turkey next door, Jim. How is that all affecting what's going on in Syria?
Well, it means the Turks can't really concentrate on doing anything dramatic in Syria. So as far as Syria is concerned, the Turks are on automatic right now. The government is playing hardball with the opposition. Basically, half the people didn't vote, you know, for the Islamist government in Turkey. They are unhappy with being ignored. And the government's basically saying, we are in power, and now they're threatening to unleash the army, which could be interesting, on the demonstrators. It's basically a standoff. It may take a while to resolve itself. And in the meantime, Turkey's going to be out of action in Syria. Syria, getting involved in Syria, getting involved in any Arab problems has always been unpopular in Turkey. Like, as I've said before, there's an old Ottoman era, Turkish saying about, do not involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs. And what they normally did was they would put, like in what is modern day Iraq, or at least two thirds of Iraq, way around Baghdad and down south by Basra, they put the local Sunni minority in charge. They do whatever Iraq you do, just send money and don't give us a lot of problems. And occasionally, when things got really out of hand, the Turks would go down, kill a lot of people, and when they quieted down, they go away and told the Sunnis, all right, now let's go back to where we like it. That always left a bad taste in the mouths of the Turks, because they, like everyone else who's tried to conquer the area, has had no end of problems. This is nothing new. This is ancient history. And as you can see, it keeps happening, repeating and repeating and repeating itself. So the Turks have never had an incentive in the first place to get heavily involved in Syria. And now they have less because they have their own domestic, Turkish spring, as it were. So Saudi Arabia is basically carrying the ball. They're calling they're a shot caller now. They are under a lot of domestic pressure. There are hardliners in the Gulf Arab world to not let Iran win this one. And whether or not it'll get to the point where the Arab Gulf states will start sending in their own fighting troops remains to be seen, because that's a bridge they haven't wanted to cross yet. The Iranians, on the other hand, and the Iraqis have had no problem with helping to recruit Shia Arabs to go fight in Syria. And there's a lot, there's hundreds, probably 3,000 at this point, have gone there. And they proved enthusiastic, if not very, you know, disciplined and efficient fighters. But if the Gulf states, the Sunni Arabs, start doing that in a big way, then it does give the rebels a another edge. But like I say, the big problem is logistics. You know, the rebels got plenty of enthusiasm, but they need weapons, they need bullets. And the biggest problem is they need coordination. I mean, they are literally feuding with each other. I mean, there've only been some serious fights between the Sunni rebels and the Kurds. And there's still tension, but there's always been tension between the Kurds who are Indo-European and the, you know, the Arabs who are Semites. But among themselves, not just between the Islamic radicals and the, you know, the moderates, the Democrats, whatever you want to call it, the Democrats are divided into many little factions, based upon tribal allegiance, where they're from, and politics. The radicals, they are also split, as we reported in the strategy page. There's a big beef between the Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Al-Qaeda group in Nusra in Syria. The Iraqis were trying to basically set up a third organization to siphon away foreign volunteers from Nusra, and that caused a big stink. And Al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, hiding somewhere, you know, in Pakistan, basically issued a public order for the Iraqis to back off, and the back off, and Iraqis ignored it. So there's bad blood, so to speak, and sometimes there's literally blood. And this obviously does not help your cause if you cannot depend on everybody to coordinate. And even if they do agree to coordinate, these guys are not pros. So even with the best of intentions and the greatest amount of enthusiasm, they don't always pull off, you know, united, you know, joint operations. So they have a lot of problems. But long term, I don't think there's any question that the rebels are going to win. It's a question of how many Syrians are going to be killed for that to be achieved.
Austin.
I think I agree with Jim on the long haul. There's just way too many people in Syria who despise the Assads and want to replace the Assads with something better. Turkey. Turks are still involved very much in Syria at the intelligence level, special operations forces level, political level. I mean, they're a refuge for the Syrian opposition. Like Jordan, they are a logistical platform, but they're a much more advanced logistical platform, Dan, because of the development in Turkey and the border area as it already exists. Now, the internal turmoil, though, in Turkey, that does take pressure off of the Assads. In one operational scenario, is I just don't see the Turks putting together a buffer zone, which is something that Erdogan's government and several senior military officials over the last 2 years have vetted, suggested, threatened. Just because there is no buffer zone doesn't mean that you no-fly zone. Jim mentioned that the rebels want air support. I can see the Turks still getting lining up with a NATO-led no-fly zone. And it would be enforced primarily from Turkey, the big NATO air base there in southeastern Turkey and the various Turkish air force bases, plus supported by some of the anti-aircraft and surface-to-air missile batteries that are along the on the Turkey side of the Turkey-Syrian border. Some other things. Jim mentioned the Kurds. That Kurdish party, the BDP, is in an interesting situation now. It's become something of a it's a minor party, but they've got a kind of a swing power now in domestic politics. What's interested me too is that this PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, rebel withdrawal seems to be proceeding in dribs and drabs, but with very, very few reports of any troubles. The Turkish Kurds are just tired of fighting, and their leader, Apo Öcalan, he really, really wants a deal. Doesn't mean that there aren't going to be radicals that are going to try to toss a grenade into the room. You could see Iranian agents operating through Iranian Kurdish, like PJAC. I've thought of some scenarios that could occur where they try to upset that component in Turkey domestically. I mean, it could happen, but it looks like overwhelmingly among Turkish Kurds, they want to make a deal. As for Erdogan, Prime Minister Erdogan, well, he played himself. He was at first he says he's not going to talk to anybody in the opposition and the demonstrators, and then he says he will, and then he comes on very hard and unleashes the police, and this plays well with his Islamist supporters in the Justice and Development Party, but it's alienated elements of the opposition, and as Jim says, half the country didn't vote for him. Is this going to gel into a coherent political opposition that's going to defeat him at the polls in the presidential election 2014? Don't know, but that's something that has the turmoil has certainly created. That possibility where Erdogan looked extremely powerful in late 2012, even as the Turkish economy was having some hiccups, he doesn't look undefeatable now. The last thing I guess I ought to say is that have you followed this, Jim, about the standing man phenomenon that broke out?
Yes.
It's really rather interesting.
They'll always figure out a way.
Oh, I mean, it's extremely clever. Dan, what this is that there was a performance artist, an actor in Istanbul who, all right, Prime Minister Erdogan had a point. There were anarchists, leftist anarchists that were a tiny element, but showing up in these demonstrations, throwing bottles, throwing bricks, and who knows, some of them could easily have been operated on behalf of the Assads. There was indications, at least on some of Erdogan's supporters, to say, hey, wait a minute, these are some Syrian troublemakers. Could have been. And, of course, the Assads would have been stupid not to take advantage of these demonstrations. Plus, this is something I can say that's overwhelmingly popular among the Turkish population. They don't want to see the police putting down legitimate political protests, but they don't like riots. They don't like riots at all. And so Erdogan was attempting to appeal to a legitimate concern. So here comes this performance artist, actor, and what he does is he walks, this was just this past Monday, he walks into a square in Istanbul, and the square's been emptied of all the demonstrators and all the various graffiti and signs and posters, and all that's left in the square are huge Turkish flags, nationalist flags, and a large poster of Kemal Atatürk. And so he just goes there and stands. And the police do nothing. He's not breaking any law. He can stand there. Well, by Tuesday, you had, I read various reports, 800, 1,100, 2,000 people just coming there and standing there at various times. And it's kind of broken out in other places throughout Turkey. And what this is a quiet opposition. And this is something that frustrates Erdogan's I'm responding to the anarchist threat in the streets. These aren't anarchists. Making a very clever statement that plays well imagistically. I mean, it shows up. This has showed up on Facebook. This is in all of the Turkish newspapers, even the ones that are very pro Erdogan and pro AKP. And it's gone viral on in internet videos. And as Jim says, the Turks figure out a way. This is extremely clever, and who knows? It might be that we are going to see this anti-Erdogan political opposition gel. It may mean that the current president, Gül, gets elected president, but all right, well, so be it. Erdogan Erdogan gets his just desserts, and he gets it in a democratic way.
Well, I think we'll be talking about Syria and Turkey again before the summer's over. It looks like things are going to continue to bubble and boil there.
It's fascinating stuff, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah.
Totally is.
Well, we'll talk to both of you next time, and have a good week.
Take care, guys.
Take care.